It's a world in which we are called to pay attention to other people in a way that is maybe not necessarily easy, and to be treating other people as if they're incredibly important. And there are certainly ways that technology can help us do that, but I worry that many of the postures that our devices encourage are actually against seeing other people as truly image bearers, and instead kind of distract us into a world in which it's all about the self.
I actually feel like people are looking for a better, different way very actively. There are some trends in our culture and our world that seem to me to be kind of decisively going in the wrong way. I am worried about those. But the way that we relate to these new layers, including things not yet invented or at least not yet widely released, there's such ferment about this. In every home, people are questioning whether this is really the life we're meant to have.
Hi, I'm Amy Crouch, and I'm a student at Cornell University and the author of My TechWise Life.
I'm Andy Crouch. I am the partner for theology and culture at Praxis, which is an organization that works to advance redemptive entrepreneurship in the world, and a writer of a number of books, one of which was called The TechWise Family, and now a co-author on Amy's book.
Welcome to Language of God. I'm Jim Stump. In 2017, Andy Crouch wrote The TechWise Family, a practical book about keeping technology in its proper place within the demands of modern family life. Well, one member of the Crouch family has grown up a bit since he wrote that book, and we get to see how this approach has worked out. Andy's daughter, Amy, is now a university student and has written her own book about growing up in a TechWise family and the ongoing commitment to using technology wisely. In this episode, I talk with father and daughter about the new book, My TechWise Life. It's a fun conversation that ranges from the relationship of science and technology to whether today's technological innovations are different from those in the past, to practical steps we can all take to make sure technology aids in rather than detracts from us living the kinds of lives God called us to. Let's get to the conversation. Well, Amy Crouch and Andy Crouch, welcome to the podcast. We're very happy to be talking to you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jim.
So, Amy, you have this new book, My TechWise Life, which, as I understand it, you wrote the entire manuscript, then gave it to your dad, who offered some reflection and commentary on each chapter in the form of a letter back to you. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay. So, did you ever change anything in your chapters because of what he wrote back to you?
Not drastically. I will say the manuscript that I gave to Dad was my first draft. And so after Dad added his portions, we went through a whole general round of editing. And so, yes, a few things changed, but pretty much what you read in the book is mostly what I gave to Dad.
Jim, are you trying to discern whether Amy wrote this freely and not under compulsion from her body?
I was wondering if there were ever comments like, now, come on, Amy, it didn't happen that way when you were growing up, or please don't tell the world this thing about our parenting, any of those kind of...
No. Nope. I kept our family secrets safe.
Just remember, Amy, we're normal people. We're normal people.
So the book must have had its origin in your dad's 2017 book, The TechWise Family, for which I see that you wrote the foreword as a 16-year-old, calling yourself test subject number two for the kind of parenting your dad was advocating for with respect to technology. I'm just curious, when did you first think, you know, I think there's another book here, maybe, from the perspective of test subject number two?
Well, it was something that we talked about and maybe joked about for a while, pretty much as the TechWise family was going out and being read, because that is a great book. Dad did a wonderful job, but it is fair to say that it's addressed to parents. It's mainly talking to parents about what they can implement in their family. And that is very much needed. Parents need guidance. But Dad and I both agreed that, you know, kids need guidance. People my age, I'm 20 right now, and, you know, I was 19 when I ended up writing this book. people my age, we want to be talking about technology. We want to be understanding what kinds of choices we can make that will improve our relationship with our devices. And so really from the beginning, Dad and I had this idea that it would be really great to speak to kids and young people directly.
Mm. Besides growing up in a tech-wise family, what else has prepared you to write this book or any book in particular, in general, I guess?
Well, we might talk about this more later, but to be honest, Dad writes in the book, and I agree with this, the secret of the book is that it's not really about technology. Mm. This book is really about a whole set of principles that you bring to life that help us discern technology. It's about, if we take the title Tech Wise Life, it's more about the wise life than the tech. Mm. And so I think in writing this book, I felt like I was bringing in all of the family discussions and kind of my education that comes to bear on what is a wise life and how can we live wisely. So my college classes, but also even the family dinner conversations that we had about what makes life worth living, how can we be glorifying God with our day-to-day, everyday lives. And I was just speaking specifically about technology, but using those very broad Christian principles.
Well, we are going to talk about technology, which is not quite the same thing as science, but they're related. And because we are BioLogos, I have to ask about science and your relationship to it. So, Amy, I'm tempted to ask, like, how your grades have been in science classes, but that might be prying a bit too much. But anything you could give us here that indicates to our audience that you are indeed pro-science or have had positive relationships to science or anything like that?
Yes. Well, to be honest, when I was young, the thought that there could be such a thing as sort of pro-science or anti-science was really not something in my mind. My mom is a scientist. She's a physics professor, actually, at our local college. And so I always, from the first day that at least I was able to have conversations with my mom, I thought of science as this valuable tool, a way that humans were able to kind of to explore God's creation, to understand even in a small way, the Creator's marvelous creations. And so I honestly, for a while, didn't really know that there was any kind of sense that science and Christianity could be in conflict. Mm. Of course, I knew that, like any tool, science could be used in a way that wasn't good, because any tool can be used to a poor end. But I was... always curious about the natural world. I always loved to ask my mom so many questions, mm-hmm. which were actually very difficult and complicated. And she handled those with such grace. And so I've always been curious about the world. And while I'm not necessarily interested in becoming like an experimental scientist, I would say that sense of curiosity, that idea that the world is worth investigating, has always been a part of my life.
Mm. Andy, anything from spouse of physics professor?
Yeah, I'm actually thrilled that my kids, Amy's brother Timothy and she got to grow up in a home where the work and findings of science were just treated with such delight and interest. And one other thing I would say, Jim, I mean, we maybe could talk a little more about this as we go, is there is really a big difference between science and technology. Right. And the way that, mm-hmm. that I would summarize it, I think there are perhaps multiple ways to describe it, but one way to put it is technology is easy and science is hard. Mm-hmm. So technology, from the point of view of the end user, is designed to be extremely reliable, to be ideally as simple as possible for the user to operate, to get what they want. And of course, it's built on a lot of engineering, which is very painstaking and which is in a way a form of more scientific work. But then behind that is the incredibly painstaking, unpredictable, unreliable in some ways, or kind of two steps forward, one step back work of scientific investigation, which my wife has done as an experimental physicist. And I think for our kids to grow up seeing science from that side, kind of the view from behind the tapestry where everything's kind of messy and experiments don't always work every day because, you know, technology is designed to work every day. Like, we're relying on our recording software and the whole technology stack we're depending on here. We can, right, with 99.999% trust it'll work. And in the physics lab, when you're at the frontiers of science, you're at like, 99% chance it's not going to work the first time. And the other thing that I think my kids absorbed from my wife, Catherine, and her calling is how often in science you find out you were wrong about something, your instincts about the natural world, not least in physics, where even just basic mechanics, but, you know, let alone quantum mechanics, really doesn't match what our intuitive experience of the world is like. And so there's so much unlearning involved in a scientific education. And Catherine was so great about helping our kids not leapfrog over that difficulty and the unlearning and the perplexity and complexity. So they grew up really seeing science as it's done by scientists, not just the end results that many of us get to benefit from, which is the technological application of the hard, long dead ends and surprises that scientists encounter in their work.
So I don't at all want to set up your book as sounding like it's anti-technology, but I just want to press this point a little bit further to say being pro-science is not the same as being pro-technology or anti-science and anti-technology, right? Those are different kinds of questions that we're asking.
Totally. I mean, Amy, I'm sure you have thoughts about this too, but I actually, if I could venture a controversial, semi-controversial idea that I am not entirely positive I can defend, it's actually striking to me how many people who reject a lot of the findings of modern science actually are quite involved. They're very grateful, active beneficiaries of technology. Yep. And sometimes it is interesting, a not small number of them are engineers, actually, who in one domain are involved in kind of applying science. But I think technology actually fools us about how easily we can know the truth about our world. And to me, the great we are not anti-technology at all in our family. The books are definitely not anti-technology or against the use of technology in its proper place. What I do worry about is the way technology leads us to think the world is simpler than it is, easier to comprehend than it is, and unrequiring, if I can put it that way, of specialist knowledge. Because technology, ultimately, when it's delivered to the end user, is designed to relieve you of having to be a specialist. I'm not an audio engineer, but I'm speaking through a microphone that an audio engineer designed, and I don't have to know anything of the complexity that audio engineer knew who designed this microphone, or actually the many, many engineers who went into that. And so I can be seduced into thinking, well, my intuitions about the world are surely pretty much right. So I think technology, the kind of spiritual or intellectual effect of inviting us to imagine that the world is quite simple and straightforward and common sense, which actually a huge amount of design went into giving you that momentary feeling that the world kind of works the way you want it to work, robs us of the burden and the delight of scientific knowledge, which is more demanding in a way. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
That's interesting. Yep.
Yeah.
Okay, let's talk a little more specifically about technology and your book here. So, Amy, more than once, you already alluded to the fact here that your dad has it in the letters at the end of the chapters, more than once said, you're not really writing about technology. And the way you introduced that already, I suspect that you don't think that was just dad doing some mansplaining there at the end of the chapters.
No.
But that you think he's right.
Dad-splaining.
My tech-wise life is more fundamentally about something other than your relationship to technology. So let's dig in a little deeper there. How would you describe what your book is really about, what the aim of it is?
Yeah. Well, I think to take the really, really large scale answer to that, this book is about what it means to be a human being. And specifically, it's about what it means to be created in God's image and called to bear his image in the world. And really what I want people to do with this book is, as I say many times, it's not to get you to like throw your phone out the window, but it's to ask questions about how your use of technology is affecting you as a bearer of God's image and how it's influencing the way that you live out God's calling for you. And I think that one of the key applications of that is a world in which every single person is made in God's image and worthy of love and attention is a world in which we are called to be communicating and connecting on a very deep level with other people. It's a world in which we are called to pay attention to other people in a way that is maybe not necessarily easy, and to be treating other people as if they're incredibly important. And there are certainly ways that technology can help us do that, but I worry that many of the postures that our devices encourage are actually against seeing other people as truly image bearers, and instead kind of distract us into a world in which it's all about the self. And so none of that has to be true. And I really want readers to explore new ways that they can be oriented towards that calling of bearing the image rather than the very weak distractions and substitutes that our devices can offer.
So you've said the goal isn't necessarily to get people to toss their phones out, to use their technological devices less. But I wonder if maybe it should be, given what we've learned about this. I mean, is this just you two trying not to be the overbearing parent? And the reason I ask this is a couple episodes back, we talked to Rosalind Picard from MIT, who runs a technology lab. And she described to us this randomized controlled trial of students at the University of Pennsylvania, where they randomly assign people to use Facebook, Snapchat, Instagram the way they normally do, or to limit themselves to only 10 minutes per day for 3 weeks. And once this 3 weeks was up, they looked at a lot of different pre and post measures to see what changed. And they found, this won't surprise you, I'm sure, the group that was limited to 10 minutes per day on these social networks showed clinically significant reductions in loneliness and depression. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And those who used these as usual didn't show any reduction. So my question is, if the data is really that clear that the more prolonged use of these social networks is going to make you lonelier and more depressed, should we take a stronger stand about limiting their use?
Well, I mean, yes, I think that discipline is central to how we should engage with these technologies. And when I say that the book is not about throwing the phone out the window, I'm not saying that we should have no discipline. I'm mainly just saying that going from one extreme to another is not necessarily the way to health. And blaming all of your problems on technology will ultimately not solve them. And so instead, what I advocate for in the book is really a very ancient Christian and not just Christian idea, which is of implementing disciplines, both kind of spiritual and bodily, and being practicing self-examination, really, about our use of devices, and then implementing disciplines, which may challenge us, around our use of them. And so I certainly would not want to suggest that discipline is unimportant, but I think that any discipline needs to be undertaken with the right framing, the right understanding of why it is we're doing it. Mm-hmm. I mean, to be honest, I think of, for instance, there's this enormous trend in kind of Silicon Valley, which is that the CEOs and higher ups in giant tech corporations send their kids to like screen-free, super expensive private preschools. Right. And to be honest, I mean, I don't want to make sort of unkind assumptions, but I think that that is a selfish means of discipline, to be honest. I think that looking at, renouncing technology or whatever as being basically some way that you maximize like your own excellence is not good. And I want us to be disciplined in our approach to technology, but I want us to be doing it in a way that is focused on God and neighbor rather than self-improvement.
Andy, any further thoughts from you on this as one who, in your previous book, did advocate for limiting uses of technology, right? Sure. So in the face of some of these studies that show this really isn't very good for you, how strong a stand should we take societally? I mean, this is America, right? Freedom, and we don't tell people what to do.
Yes. Well, I mean, a very fundamental Christian insight is that things that promise us untrammeled freedom often end up being the most powerful things that actually enslave us and lead to compulsion. And certainly that applies especially to a lot of these, you know, algorithm-driven, reward-driven, ultimately dopamine-driven social media platforms and news platforms and other things like that. And I think we're right to be quite wary of those. I don't know the details of that specific study that Roz may have talked about. It's totally plausible to me. I think unfettered use of almost any of these, certainly these media platforms, is very unlikely to be good for human beings. And so I'm not at all surprised that putting some limits on it helps. I do think it would be interesting to do further iterations of that experiment, if you will, because I wonder if is it the case that the relationship between the amount of time I spend on these platforms and my mental health is kind of monotonic and linear and just sort of a straight line, like the more time I spend, the worse off I am? Mm-hmm. Or it could be the case that actually there's a kind of step function here that actually is basically about making an intentional choice. So be that 10 minutes a day, or in our books, both Amy's and mine, we really encourage this idea of at a minimum 1 hour a day, 1 day a week, and 1 week a year, where you turn everything off that has an off switch and disengage. And that's a lot more use potentially than 10 minutes a day. Mm-hmm. But in my experience, just the act of every Sunday saying, no, I'm not doing that today. Every dinner time, plugging the phone in far away, not looking at it for at least an hour. In the summers, turning off my email, I actually do it for 2 weeks, and I just don't have any email for 2 weeks. That has made a huge difference in the rest of my time with these various technological supplements to my life. Mm-hmm. We could do further work and find out, no, actually, even a minute a day, like it's like cigarettes, you know, like, I mean, we'd rather that you only smoke one than 10, but you really, the fewer cigarettes you smoke, the better off your lungs are going to be in the long run, right? Maybe it is like that, or maybe it's that these, the default settings of our devices encourage a kind of always on, always plugged in life that we were never meant for. And just the act of pulling the plug or changing the setting kind of puts you back in the human driver's seat. And it becomes about what is really best for me and my calling as a human being, rather than what's best for the makers of these devices and the platforms that make money off of them. So I think there's more to be learned. And I wouldn't be totally shocked to discover, no, actually, these are just bad. but the truth is, if you turn off Facebook, Snapchat, TikTok, you are still immersed in a technological world. There will be new platforms that will emerge, some of which will purport to be much better for you. They'll, you know, the Calm app, the, you know, whatever will come along. And I think the fundamental questions that we're trying to get at will remain, even if we take some of these more addictive or damaging manifestations of technology off the table.
Hi, Language of God listeners, here at BioLogos, we think that asking questions is a worthwhile part of any faith journey. We hope this podcast helps you to think through long-held questions and consider new questions, but you probably have other questions we haven't covered yet. That's why we want to take this quick break to tell you about the Common Questions page on our website. You'll find questions like, how could humans have evolved and still be made in the image of God? How should we interpret the Genesis flood account? And what created God? Each with thoughtful and in-depth answers written in collaboration by scientists, biblical scholars, and other experts. Just go to biologos.org and click the Common Questions tab at the top of the page. Back to the show.
Okay, I'm a philosopher by training, and so can't help but dive in a little more into the analysis of the words we're using here. And the way you use technology seems to mean primarily computerized devices and the applications we access through them. But the word technology comes from ancient Greece, where they too had techne, which were the results of human productions of some sort. And so you tell this really interesting story in the book of two different restaurants, one the local diner where everybody knows each other and even the food preparation happens out in the open, versus a Panera where you order online maybe and the kitchen is walled off from the consumers. And you had kind of a throwaway comment there saying, of course the walls built around the kitchen and the height of the counter aren't technological. To which I wrote in the margins of your book there saying, well, walls were technological to people in 10,000 BC when permanent settlements were just becoming a thing, right?
Indeed.
That must have really changed people's lives. Now, that has nothing to do with the story you were telling about the restaurants, which I think was really interesting. But it got me thinking about whether our technology today is really so different, because cars and books and walls were all technological innovations at one point in human history. So that's a long prelude to me asking you this question. What about people who say, now come on, every generation has to grapple with new technology. Digital technology is nothing new in that regard, and one day will seem just as normal and part of our experience as books and cars and indoor bathrooms are now. Is there really something different about digital technology?
Well, I'm very glad that you bring this up, because I am a linguist. I'm studying, among many other things, how words are used, what they mean, how we should use them. And this is actually something that I agonized over, which is that the word technology, even as much as it is often used to just refer to, you know, our apps, our iPhones, really does not mean things with a microchip. It's a very old word, as you mentioned, you know, the techne. And we have been creating things that alter the way we interact with the world for millennia. Perhaps you could say that's one of the things that makes us human. And so I will say that I considered these semantic problems and I wasn't happy about them, but I felt like it was the idiom that people use when they talk about our devices is in fact technology, especially shortened to, you know, tech. And so, you know, over the course of a lot of conversations with people discussing these things, it just became absolutely clear that there is an idiomatic use of technology and tech, which is useful and which applies to this sense of a reality of these kind of electronic devices and that have shaped our world. And so in some ways I don't love that I had to make that bargain, but I chose to make it because I think it is part of how we talk about this issue right now, and that creating or using a more precise term might in fact make it much less accessible to read. So that's my little linguistic
rant. I think that's fair on the linguistic side. I wonder about the deeper question then of whether our response to these new kinds of technologies is fundamentally different in some way than previous generations had to respond to the technologies developing then.
Amy knows I have an opinion about this, but yes. I want to prevent you from giving your own opinion.
Well, I do think that Dad's answer is good. But what I will bring up is, but before I let Dad speak, I will say that you bring up this example of the person who says, oh, every generation has had to deal with new technology. This one doesn't matter either. I think the first part of that proposition is very true, but I'm not sure if we should draw the second conclusion from it. Right. It's absolutely true that every generation has had to deal with new technologies, whether it's the printing press or the laundry machine, or even, as you say, the wall. But I don't think that means that we should brush that off. You know, sometimes people kind of make fun of, I believe, Socrates, the sort of, exactly. Well, obviously Plato wrote it down, this idea of, oh, once we have writing, then our whole tradition of oral learning will disappear. And people are like, oh, so silly. People were worrying about writing and books. But actually, as wonderful as the innovation of the technology of writing is, it did totally change the way that we processed the world. And I just wrote a book, so I am not anti-writing, but I think that we need to say, like, yes, this new, brand new technology, as much as we take it for granted now, did completely change the world. And we should be understanding how that happened. And so Even if you say digital technology is the same as other technologies, it won't be any more impactful, I don't think that means that we should dismiss it. Because sure. Every time new technology enters, it can transform us, and we should be asking how that will happen.
There's an amazing book by Richard Baucom, the New Testament scholar, called Jesus and the Eyewitnesses, that while it uses the word eyewitness, which implies sight, what it's actually about is oral memory. And he kind of surveys the research about oral cultures and their ability to remember, especially kind of well-structured narrative or teaching type speech, such that a member of an oral culture would be able to listen to this whole podcast and recite back days later whole sections of it verbatim from memory in a way that those of us who are fully embedded in a literate culture can't imagine. So yeah, I'm with Amy. I think that the second part, people have always worried about this, therefore we don't need to worry, or especially even a kind of stronger claim, therefore we don't need to attend to what's happening and how this is changing us and whether we want it to change us in the way it's changing us. You know, there is something really being lost. I do have a thought about it's a core question, Jim, that you're asking. You know, haven't we always had technology? How is this really, is it really different in kind? And actually, to push on the linguistic issue a bit, we have always had tools. That's along with art and reverence for the human body and decoration of the body, that's like the evidence of finding a human in the archaeological record is some combination of tools and burying the dead and making art. The word technology itself is a coinage. It comes first into the English language in the 17th century, so it's a while ago, but it doesn't come to its current meaning until quite recently. And why did we need another word beyond tool or beyond technique, which we also had, which was the more direct kind of heir of the word techne? And I think it's because something really has changed. And the simplest way I can put it is, almost all of the things we human beings brought into the world by our own ingenuity in the long, long history of tool making required human skill to operate. It operated in concert with a human body, mind, soul, heart complex, which is what it is to be a person. And the unique thing, which was dreamed of back in the time of Aristotle writes about, what if we one day had flutes that played themselves, like, or harps that strummed themselves? We wouldn't need slaves anymore, he says. Who would normally play those instruments at a banquet? So there's been this dream of automaticity, for a long time, especially in the Western world. And there are analogs to it in other cultures. But it wasn't until the modern scientific method unlocked some key kind of secrets about the world, including the harnessing of energy, which we had ways to do, but not in the way we did once we figured out electricity, basically, batteries and engines and that kind of stuff. Once we had a whole new kind of power, all the way down to milliamps for microchips and all the way up to, you know, a rocket to launch a satellite into orbit, and new kinds of control systems, cybernetics, that allowed us to create these internal feedback loops within mechanisms, first mechanical, then computational. Suddenly, we were able to do something that had always been dreamed of, but had rarely been really accomplished, and that was for things to operate by themselves without us being involved, especially without our intelligence, attention, and skill being involved. And that doesn't mean that there's not a lot of skill that goes into building these things. So again, the engineers who created the microphones we're using had a huge amount of skill and deployed that in really ingenious ways that fully involved them. But for me, my microphone is almost literally a black box, black cylinder, mm-hmm. where I get to do my thing without ever having to attend and indeed having no real functional knowledge of how it works. And in my book, I call that easy everywhere. The idea that now things just operate on their own. And I don't have to know how my furnace works. I used to have to know how the hearth worked, how to chop the wood, stack the wood, bring the wood in, cover the fire at night so there would still be fire in the morning. I used to have to be very involved in the heating of my home. Now it just happens without me. I think that is new. I think that's certainly as dramatic a revolution as the introduction of writing as the primary means of transmission of knowledge. And I have all the same questions and concerns that Socrates had.
Yeah. It may have sounded like I was pushing for the answer that, no, this is just all the same, but I actually totally agree with you in this regard. And one further aspect of that example here, one of my spiritual heroes is John Wesley, who lived in the 18th century in England. Yeah. He didn't really do apologetics as we think of it today, but in one of his essays, he argued that everybody naturally considers religious ideas because our lives are filled with blank spaces during which we can't help but reflect and turn our minds toward God. Wow. And I'm not sure if this holds up today, but he said, indeed, it is obvious that the earth as it is now constituted, even with the help of all European arts, does not afford sufficient employment to take up half the waking hours of half its inhabitants. Could he say that today, that there just aren't enough things to keep us busy? And, you know, that's what I wonder if technology, and this goes to your point, Andy, of what you were saying too, but this digital technology that's so different from previous technologies in how easily it expands to take up all of our attention.
Wow. Wow. And it's interesting. Wesley is not writing that in what was prejudicially called the Dark Ages, you know, a time of great technological recession. He's living in the midst of an urban environment, highly advanced society in many ways. And yet he has that feeling of permeability to the natural world, of silence being part of life. Mm-hmm. I think that's so interesting. And I do think there's no way anyone could write that today.
Right.
One of the most important disciplines that I didn't start doing until I was writing my TechWise Family book, but one of the most important spiritual disciplines in my life has been this simple adjustment to what I do in the mornings. I used to get up in the mornings. We don't have phones in the bedrooms in our house, so we park them downstairs. But I would come downstairs, you know, barely awake, and start my tea being made, which I do with the help of technology, I should say. And while the tea was brewing, I'd pick up my phone and, you know, I don't know, check Twitter, check email, whatever. And it dawned on me while I was writing the TechWise Family, this is a horrible way to start the day. Like, this, surely there's a better thing to do than this first thing, because it would arouse all kinds of anxiety, you know, urgency, whatever, and just terrible way to start. So I started going outdoors first thing in the morning. I make my tea, and then no matter the season, no matter the weather. So I would say every day There might be one or two exceptions, but for years now, every single morning, unless I was staying in like a high-rise hotel somewhere, the first thing I do when I wake up is walk outside. Well, second thing, I do make my tea first. we're going to have another conversation about addiction and dependence. And holding my tea in my hand, some days it's raining. This morning, it was like 34 degrees here in Philadelphia. It was a little humid. There was one bird singing. I know what phase of the moon it is now. I never used to know that. And I feel all these things that I don't feel when I'm indoors, cocooned in my technological environment. There is that silence and space that Wesley wrote about. It has been revolutionary for my sense of composure, my prayer life, and the rest of my day. But I have to choose it, because I could easily fill every moment of every day with a world that really revolves around me, that's always the right temperature for me, that's always responding to my interests and desires through algorithms. And man, stepping out of that back into the world that we actually were made to inhabit as image bearers has been amazing.
Amy, this the trajectory of the conversation here right now brings up another really important point that you make, which is that technology isn't neutral, right? Lots of people say, well, technology isn't good or bad. It's just how you use it. And of course, we can point to lots of examples on both sides. But you allude several times to the fact that technology itself does something to us, that it fosters certain habits or facilitates a way of life. How would you describe what technology does to us?
I would say it has to do with design. So you're absolutely right that people say technology is neutral. There are people who will say, well, Facebook can be used for good and it can be used for bad, although maybe fewer now. There are people who will say, you know, video games. There are people who say whatever. Video games can be a positive form of entertainment or a negative form of entertainment. And I think there's a grain of truth, but the problem is anything that is designed by people or by God will not be neutral, because the very act of creating something and designing something, in that act, you have to come up with a whole bunch of answers to questions about like the purpose of human behavior, the purpose of your own creation, and really of, as I mentioned before, what it means to be a person. So that's very large scale, looking at this on a smaller level. Thinking about, for instance, social media. When you design a form of social media, you're assuming so many needs. You're assuming, for instance, that people don't see all of the people they want to connect with on a given day. That's probably true. You're assuming that if you're designing a text-based platform, you're assuming that the thing that people really need is to be able to sort of send words to each other. If you're designing a picture-based platform, you're saying, no, what people really are looking for is to be sending images to one another. All of these kinds of questions and answers about what people really need. We can see this with productivity software, which is built around the idea that people are not getting enough done, maybe because they're distracted by technology. We can see this with, you know, video games or online entertainment, which is people are bored and people want something to do. And we're going to create a platform where perhaps an algorithm will give you what you need because you can't figure it out on your own. There are 1,000 examples of this, and I think we need to face the reality that technology has to be, inherently anything must be designed with a set of assumptions about who people are and what they need. And that means that even as you can use a device for a variety of different purposes, you are still being shaped by what the designers of that device thought you needed and thought was true about people. And honestly, I think that the technologies which are dominating our lives right now are unfortunately not founded on the real deep truths about the human way of life.
It's surprising to some people to hear how deliberately those technologies have been designed to foster addiction and dependence, right?
Totally. I always want to say, first of all, technology is very good. I don't think it's neutral. I think it's very good in the way that when God has created human beings, male and female, God's final word before he rests on the seventh day is, behold, it's very good. And I think human activity in the world extends the goodness of creation up till the sixth day. God has just said it's good, it's good, it's good. I think human activity, including technology, is fundamentally very good. But, of course, the lesson of biblical faith is that even this very goodness that is inherent in us as human beings, that's inherent in our works, has been distorted and actually is put in the service of false beliefs about what the world is like, what God is like, what human beings are like. And then it doesn't become neutral. It becomes actually destructive, damaging, deceptive, distorting. But never neutral. I just don't think we don't live in a neutral world. We human beings, we live in a very good world that we distort because we don't actually remember or trust who we are meant to be. And that, to me, is really the story of how technology has unfolded, both in the very long story of techne, but also in the specific story of what we moderns call technology.
So, the effects of technology, then there's some relationship between them and the environment we're in. And our world has changed pretty drastically here the last year. I assume you must have pretty well finished the manuscript before the pandemic started, right? And I wonder if there's anything different we might say about technology and its use and its effects on us, given the events of the last year. For example, we saw the role of technology in the spread of disinformation, a use of technology that brought about fairly destructive consequences. But on the other hand, FaceTime and Zoom were the only means of community for some people for many, many months throughout all of this. Yep. Have you reflected at all any further on use of technology given the world as it is these days?
Yes. Well, regarding the manuscript, I will say we were doing sort of final edits in May, I believe, of 2020, April or May. And so we were thinking about this. We were like, oh my goodness, what can we be saying right now? And, you know, Dad and I came to the conclusion that we didn't need to make any drastic changes because of the way that this book is not about sort of specific rules, although it includes lots of practical, you know, tips. Because it is about self-examination and the implementation of discipline and this overall, you know, shift in worldview, that this book didn't need to be changed too much. What I will say, though, is that I think in some ways this year has been revealing of both what technology can do and what technology cannot do. Yeah. Honestly, this is true of a lot of crisis. Crisis reveals. In fact, you know, the term apocalypse or even our use of revelation to refer to the apocalypse vision. So kalupto is the Greek verb for sort of to hide or to cover up. And apokalupto has a prefix, which Greek prepositions are complicated, but essentially meaning an apokalypsis is an uncovering. It is an unhiding. And so I think that we have seen that happen in our own little mini apocalypse of 2020. We have seen the power of technology, both for very good things and for very awful things, revealed.
Insight.
I think that's so right. I think it really has unveiled the very goodness. I mean, we're all incredibly astonished and grateful at how quickly these new vaccine platforms that had been developed a while ago but had not been tried were able to be deployed, it seems, with great efficacy. And it's going to be so good to get those two shots. bring it on, as far as I'm concerned. And that's technology at its most. I think the relief of absurd suffering, which is so much of the human condition, is a really good thing. And technology has done that better and more reliably than any other single thing in human history. But on the other side, I do think the intoxication with the idea that what we're really, that somehow being wired, especially in our relationships, in our learning, in our worship and our formation as Christians, that somehow going virtual will be good for us, which I think has been an animating dream of a lot of the development of digital technologies. Like, we will have more capacity. We'll be able to connect with more people. We'll be able to have more meaningful experiences if we go virtual. I think that's been unmasked. And from elementary schoolers to grandparents, everyone knows it's an incredible gift that for the moment we're able to connect over a screen. But everyone feels this is nothing like the real thing. This is not what we really want. And I've compared it in a couple of conversations to the bomb shelters that protected the people of London during the Blitz in the Second World War. You know, beautiful things happened in the bomb shelters. It was a kind of community and resilience and so forth that people remembered for the rest of their lives. But no one came out and said, once the bombing was over, like, oh, that was just so much better, right? No, it's a bomb shelter. Like, it's a response to a crisis. It actually has, there are ways to redeem it and actually find meaning in it that are, that you couldn't imagine beforehand. You could never imagine actually what could happen in that environment. At the same time, please, no more bomb shelters. Mm-hmm. I think people are going to say, please, no more Zoom. And college students certainly are saying, please, no more Zoom classes.
I never would have thought that I'd hear a classmate say, like, oh, I really wish I was in Rhodes Hall at 8 a.m. But that is what we are saying. Like, we hate Zoom classes.
Well, as you mentioned, Amy, there are lots of tips throughout the book, and you end each chapter with some good practical advice. How about for people hearing this conversation and maybe being introduced to the topic here for the first time? What might be a couple of good next steps for exploring a better relationship with technology?
Yeah, I think my sort of number one reframing practice, that's a really good place to start, is this principle that your phone goes to sleep before you do and it wakes up after you do. Mm-hmm. And I think that is one practice that can really transform a lot of things in your life, including, honestly, your sleep schedule. Mm-hmm. And if you want to extend this practice, then maybe it's not just nighttime. Maybe it's one day a week that you take as a Sabbath from technology. Hopefully also from work, but even just from your screens, as Dad said, turning off everything that has an off switch one day a week, something that you commit to. And what you find when you give something up is what it's doing to you. You suddenly realize, this is what my phone is telling me in the early hours of the day. This is what I'm looking at, what I would usually be looking at when I'm falling asleep at night. And I think that those two practices of phone outside the bedroom and a day a week away from technology can really shed a lot of light on how our devices are affecting us.
Yeah, I think that's really helpful. There are lots of other really great tips and insights in the book that we could probe, but our time is drawing to an end here. I wonder if we might end by looking to the future a little bit more, though. I suspect digital technology is not going away, and perhaps virtual reality and artificial intelligence, these may transform our lives over the next couple of generations as much as the internet and cell phones have transformed life this past generation. But as you look to the future, both of you, perhaps the world of your children, Amy, and of your grandchildren, Andy, the world that they grow up in, what is it that scares you or gives you pause on the one hand? And what is it that gives you hope about that world and that generation on the other hand?
Maybe I'll say something and then give Amy the last word. I don't think much about being scared about the long run, because I actually feel a great deal of hope, especially relating to this particular set of topics, because I actually feel like people are looking for a better, different way very actively. There are some trends in our culture and our world that seem to me to be kind of decisively going in the wrong way. I am worried about those. But the way that we relate to these new layers, including things not yet invented or at least not yet widely released, there's such ferment about this. In every home, people are questioning whether this is really the life we're meant to have and the kinds of relationships we're meant to have, the kinds of relationships with our neighbors we're meant to have. So there's so much chance to redesign. And I think my hope would be recognizing the amazing human propensity to screw things up. My hope would be that we begin to bend the design of our devices in the direction of what's good for persons. because I actually think it's all possible. It's all there. My wife, Catherine, Amy's mom, uses amazingly high tech, you know, in her day-to-day work as a physicist and in her work teaching about the natural world to students. And it's, to the first approximation, a totally wonderful use of all that we've learned and all these things we're able to build all the way down to the micro or even below the micro level. When we use it to extend our intellect, that is our ability to interpret the world and understand the world, when we use it to activate our sense of wonder and awe at the world, when we use it to collaborate with one another so that we're relationally engaging in the world together. And, you know, our computers can be anything we ask them to be. They're quite plastic in that sense. They're not like a machine that only does one thing. And so they can either be the ultimate device that totally disengages us, or they could more and more become merely servants. We don't ask them to do magic for us. We don't ask them to replace us. Instead, we ask them to do things that actually help us fully engage with one another and with God's world. And I think that's still possible. And to some extent, even if the economic forces that kind of drive the development of a lot of this tend in the other direction, there's always going to be hacking. So we can hack it, even when it wasn't made to function in a healthy way. We can find healthy ways. And I hope my grandchildren will be really good hackers.
Amy, well, final thoughts?
Yeah. Well, my thoughts run parallel to Dad's, because one of the things that does give me hope is just what he said, that people see there's something wrong. When I talk to my peers, fellow college students, and also people younger than me, it is remarkable how much people agree that, yeah, the way we're using our devices right now, there's something wrong with it. But my fear comes from what people usually say after that, which is, but isn't this just the way the world is now? I think that the number one obstacle in the way of digital well-being and my number one fear for the future is that people my age, even as we see that something is wrong, we feel like that's just the way the world needs to be. We've grown up with these devices for so long that they just are the reality, and we don't feel like there's a way to change that. And my hope is that people my age, people younger than me, and hopefully one day my children or my grandchildren will say, no, this is not the way life has to be, and that will be true.
Well, may that be so. The book, again, is called My Techwise Life, available through Baker Books. And I see if you prefer reading books on a digital device, it is available as an ebook. Do you recommend that?
If necessary.
Well, Amy Crouch and Andy Crouch, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Well, thank you, Jen. Such a great conversation.
Great talk.
Language of God is produced by BioLogos. It has been funded in part by the John Templeton Foundation and more than 300 individuals who donated to our crowdfunding campaign. Language of God is produced and mixed by Colin Hugerwerf. That's me. Our theme song is by Breakmaster Cylinder. We are produced out of the remote workspaces and the homes of BioLogos staff in Grand Rapids, Michigan. If you have questions or want to join in a conversation about this episode, find a link in the show notes for the BioLogos Forum. Find more episodes of Language of God on your favorite podcast app or at our website, biologos.org, where you'll also find tons of great articles and resources on faith and science. Thanks for listening.